Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I am pretty good.
Oh, good.
Pretty good. Yeah. I like to think about it and give you a real honest answer, you know?
Yeah, I have not had a productive day, mainly
Same.
because I went to work with Amy in gallery and I had real great Padron peppers, but yeah,
Oh.
not productive.
I've not been productive either, just the way that my calls were spaced out and then had a slow morning, crying in my car after the gym. No reason, just emotional. And
Did
then
Adele come
I
on?
just, not even. What was on? Oh, no, it was on. Avril Lavigne. I'm with you. That
Oh
song.
God, yeah.
That was just the radio. I didn't put it on to cry. I was completely rational. Like, it's completely fine.
What was she doing on the radio?
Digital radio, heart naughties. Oh my God, every time heart naughties in the car, it just brings me so much joy. Usually, sometimes they play
Do you
songs
remember
like
that
that.
big thing about Avril Lavigne that she had actually been replaced by somebody else?
Yeah, part of me still believes it.
Yeah, I kind of do as well.
But she was in the Kardashians recently, so then I was like, oh, she does look like Avril Lavigne, so maybe still is her. But you had your peppers. I am on cloves of garlic at the moment, raw cloves of garlic. So I've been craving olives. So I've been eating olives every day, and I've been getting M&S olives, and it's just the ultimate gift.
That's an
But
expensive snack.
here, when you've lived in Austin for 6 months of the year, M&S is like,
Yeah,
but
well,
like
I'm coming from Cape Town now, so I'm
oh,
like, gosh, everything's very expensive.
yeah, you're like, see, I'm a Lidler and then I top up for a wee treat. So, because I like to treat myself with food, I'm a dog. And so I get the olives from there, and I got ones with garlic in them, and then just the raw garlic. I just ate all of the raw garlics out of the pot in one go. It's delicious, but I'm
Wow,
questioning.
babe.
I know I'm
Wow.
questioning my sense of taste at the moment.
Yeah,
That's
well, that happens, doesn't it? I do agree that you should go and buy all the basics that, like, why are you buying dry pasta from M&S, which is going to cost you like 50% more when it tastes exactly the same from Lidl? But then with other stuff like olives, I agree. You want to go like,
Yeah.
okay, choose your indulgences and go for them and then just buy everything
Correct.
else at Lidl.
Correct. And I went to M&S this morning. And by the way, Whoops and M&S like reduced start in the morning. So I got like this big box of sal. My favorite sal was like half price. I
Oh.
got quite a few things that were on offer. And it was just like, do you know what? Top up my little lentils with that balances out pretty well. And also, whilst I can, you know. Because soon all my money will be going to someone else. Upsetting.
Oh, okay.
Anyway,
Right.
I'm going to open up the questions. Don't have them up yet. Very
Lovely.
behind.
Have you read anything exciting this week?
No. No. I did see a fantastic reel that was mocking Huel and Stephen Bartlett.
I think someone might have sent me that.
Very good.
It was really
No,
good.
I haven't been in to
I
read
think I
it.
sent it to Zoe because she just drinks Huel all the time.
It's so good. But no, I haven't. I'd got that EIQ one done. If you haven't watched it. Oh, people that are asking about the grads content that are on the current intake, the grads content we keep for grads. So just because we don't want to, like a lot of the stuff in the grads content, we reference EIQ stuff. So when I'm talking about the fertility stuff, there'll be mention of like HPO axis, etc., that is in the lecture on menstrual cycle, women's health stuff. And so it's very confusing if you're watching things that we have a lot of assumed knowledge when it comes to grad stuff. So you get access to, as soon as you finish EIQ and you do grads, you get access to all of that stuff. So you'll get access to it. The other reason is we don't want to give you all of the content now, and then you go to the grad stuff before you've done like the fundamental stuff that is really required for you to be the best coach that you can. And we don't want to overload you with stuff. So that's why we do it that way. To answer, I know there were a few questions on that.
You need to graduate, basically.
Yes, correct.
But Katie's lecture's coming up, isn't it?
Katie's lectures, it's out. It's out.
Oh, right, I'm gonna watch it tonight.
Yes, it's going to be great.
Very excited for that. Sorry,
Okay.
Dr. Katie. What's her last name again?
Dr. Katie Gambier Ross.
Oh, a little double barrel.
I know. Beautiful name.
Very
Beautiful
cute.
name, beautiful soul.
Beautiful face.
I almost went there and I thought, I'm going to go soul first. But agreed.
Okay.
Only because just me asking. Okay. Questions. Have you read anything interesting before we start?
No, but I was thinking when we were talking about Lidl and M&S, I did listen to something yesterday, and the book on it is out, I think, tomorrow. It's called Look Again. And it's kind of about like habituation and how you just become like used to what you're used to. So it might even be like a really good example is like you're used to the cost of living in Austin. So now the UK seems really cheap. And then you get used to the cost of living in Cape Town, the UK seems really expensive, right? It's like the habitualization of it. And same with like if you get used to eating Lidl stuff, and then now and again you have something from M&S, like you enjoy it that much more. If you bought everything from M&S, the enjoyment of it, like you'd very quickly become like normalized to it, and you would be like, oh, this tastes amazing. It's so much better because it would be the norm for you. And same with like you move into like an amazing house or something for the first couple of weeks, you're like, this is the best thing ever. I love being here. And then after a while, you're like, well, yeah, this is what I just wake up to every day. And their whole kind of emphasis is like, you need to change to come back to it. So like you must get this when you go away, right? Like it's really nice to come back. Like every time I come back to Dundee, I like look out the back of the house and I'm like, what an amazing view. Whereas once I've been here for honestly, like this is what's scary. Like the habitualization happens so quickly. Like 3 days in, I'm like, nah. I'm like, yeah, but I live here. It's fine. It's normal. And I guess you just see it. Like, how much do we put stuff on our stories when we're away? Because we're like, oh my God, look at this sunrise. And actually, both of us probably have better sunrises at home than it. Like, for example, in Mexico, it was nice, but like, some of the sunrises you've sent me from Liverpool or Wirral have been like way nicer than actually what we saw over there. But because it's new
Sure.
and different, you're like, oh, like this is amazing.
Oh, I bet you can use that to your advantage so much. I was thinking, so I went for a walk last night and there's a couple of blossom trees like down my street that I love. Like when they blossom, I'm just obsessed. And I never really paid attention to them until they blossomed. And recently, like I've been going past them every time I go past them and I look at them and I smell them and I'm like, oh, their blossoms are coming. And there's something about that of like, because blossom trees I love so much because we don't have them year round, right? So you when you have them, you're like, oh my God, these are amazing. So I'm like, I wonder if I can enjoy them at every stage and increase that enjoyment. And it's great because they smell great, but it all those like seasonal things you enjoy so much is one of the reasons maybe that we love the season so much, because it's like when I don't have seasons, I don't like not having seasons. I like the change. I wonder
Yeah.
if there's.
Well, I think when they talk about like applying it into different ways, I was trying to think about how to apply it into coaching. So I think, this is like a kind of a universal truth. Even if you're the best coach in the world, once you've been working with someone for a while, you kind of become a bit like habitualized that like they're used to having you're used to having them. And they were talking about this in relationships as well, where like, when you're with someone for a while, it just becomes a bit like meh. And that even just spending like 2 nights apart or having some space between each other is such a good thing for relationships. And you come back and you remember all the things that you loved about them, or like you get to miss them, and that it's the change that's important.
Interesting. I like that. Okay. Marietta's questions. I have two questions, please. One, on drinking coffee first thing, how much value is there in the claim that you should wait 90 minutes to drink coffee to wait for adenosine levels to rise and caffeine to be more effective? Is this podcast nutrition nonsense? There's
Not
no
really.
evidence.
There is an element of evidence to it. Isn't it
But
more of,
it's.
I mean, adenosine, but also like cortisol levels that rise in the morning?
Yeah, so they think, yeah. So they think that it's being more effective in terms of like having it once your cortisol begins to reduce, and then so you get like the buzz when that's starting to reduce. It's like this. I think this is a good example of like mechanistic versus like actual human data. So like mechanistically, what you said about adenosine and cortisol, like mechanistically, it makes sense. But there's zero evidence comparing having coffee in the morning versus having coffee 90 minutes later and the different impacts that it has on anything at all.
Yeah, but Amelia,
It's,
I did it and I feel totally different.
oh, well, there's your evidence of one, not
Yeah.
for
No,
you. But it is
I'm joking. I did do
that.
it, but
No, yeah, no,
that's how
yeah.
they put it. Like, well, yeah, no, like the science probably doesn't know this yet, but I do it and I've never felt better in my whole life. And it's very compelling.
Yeah. But you know what's wild? Like this is Andrew Huberman saying this on a podcast and saying he does it, talking about the mechanistic links and why that might be a thing. Other male podcasters jumping on and saying, because they bum and sorry, they really like Andrew Huberman.
Yeah, no, true, fair. Yeah.
They really like Andrew Huberman. I was already red in the face for some reason. I'm redder. And then they go and repeat it to all of their followers, and they all do it, and they're all very eloquent. And then
And now it's a fact.
hundreds of thousands of people are like, oh, yeah, but you obviously wait 90 minutes before you have your caffeine. It's like, because one man said it about, like, it's wild. But I think it's such a great question, and it raises so many, like, it raises so many important points. So thank you for asking it.
And then also nicely, what most people have done have been like, oh, we can put in a supplement here. So you shouldn't wake up and have coffee. Instead, you should wake up and have Element or whatever it's called, the salty water stuff that costs a fortune, or your athletic greens. That's what you need to do in the morning. And then you wait 90 minutes and then you have your coffee. And actually, it should be this coffee that you can buy from here because it has more natural caffeine in it or some crap, you know, like. You'll notice it just kind of like slots in nicely to their supplement regime as well. But I
Absolutely.
mean, try it and see if it helps. I think the other thing to remember as well is that a lot of people think they need a coffee. And this was something I learned from hanging out with Amelia when you weren't drinking caffeine. And I was like, oh, sometimes I'll have a decaf. Now, I'm not going to lie, sometimes you do notice that it's a decaf. But I definitely do agree with the first thing in the morning, I don't actually need caffeine. But I do, what, and I say need, like I do enjoy sitting down with a coffee in the morning and kind of just having a little bit of time to myself. It's probably not the caffeine in that that's like being the huge benefit to you. It's probably the fact you're sitting down, taking a moment, is part of your morning like ritual or routine, or it's how you kind of wake yourself up a little bit more from like a habitual and psychological point of view, behavioral point of view, than it is from like physiologically, it's the caffeine waking you up. So I do get it. And like, hey, if you don't need that in the morning, and that kind of makes logical sense as well. I'm like, I have just slept for ages. Like, why do I need a bit of a caffeine boost? Because I will probably use caffeine later in the day to be like, oh, I really want to have a bit of a work block, but I'm a bit tired because I've just had four calls back to back. And I'll probably use my caffeine then as opposed to like earlier in the day. Or maybe you want to save it for like pre-workout. But yeah, I'd consider that side of it as well.
I agree. Okay. I'm seeing increasing digestive supplements, including probiotics, being promoted online for peri and menopause. Is there evidence that digestion goes haywire in peri or menopause, well, perimenopause, and supplementation with probiotics, etc., helps?
So the drop in estrogen can impact your digestive system. So people do often get slower digestion or like sometimes just kind of like changed digestion. Is there evidence that these supplements help? I've never seen anything that's particularly convincing. I think there's quite a lot of anecdote. Again, there is with most things. I think, do you know what? I don't know if you get Nicola Guess's Substack. She wrote like a really snarky Substack about the gut microbiome and how little we know about it. And it was like, oh, such and such changes the gut microbiome. So does breathing. Ha right. Sometimes the way she writes, I'm a bit like, fucking hell. But fair enough. Like it proves the point. But some of the graphs on it were really interesting, actually, because she was like, if you care enough and know enough to actually go in and look at like the results of this, it's like, yeah, stuff changed, but this is the control group. And then she shows like the changes in the control group who, like did nothing, and the changes in like the active treatment group. And they both have huge changes, like ridiculous changes. So you can't really say that it's changing because of the certain supplement that you're taking. And yeah, I think people now know that there's this like gut brain axis, and that like the gut microbiome is doing something and it is important. But then they take that piece of knowledge into, we know how to optimize it and we know what supplements are going to help. And that's not even that link. Like, we don't know that. I don't even think we really know, although it kind of makes logical sense, that eating a lot of fruit and veg is necessarily that beneficial for some of the outcomes that it's been like proposed to be beneficial for.
Yeah, I was looking at, because think about this in terms of like menstrual cycle. If you menstruate, you know what period poops are, like you know, right? And that is because of these fluctuations in hormones. Now, of course, you know, your menstrual cycle hormone fluctuations are not the same as they are through perimenopause, but there are, you know, fluctuations. And so it's to do like as well, progesterone has an impact on smooth muscle. So smooth muscle is your digestive system. Sorry, your digestive system is smooth muscle, right? So it will impact it. But when I was looking at this, I was looking to see if there was any specific supplement stuff. And there was a meta-analysis in 2023, so only last year, that highlighted an association between gut dysbiosis and menopause. So because what the smooth muscle stuff is like obviously the slowing of digestive system, right? But then I was like, well, is there any specific things in relation to the gut microbiome that happens? I didn't know about it. And so there was a meta-analysis, and they did look at it, and they did suggest that there was this association. But the point is that, okay, so there might be this dysbiosis in the gut microbiome, but again, is a supplement that's probably expensive, that's probably promoted by someone who's invested in it or an influencer type, the answer? Or is things like managing stress, you know, increasing mindfulness, eating more slowly, eating more fiber, exercising, are these things more beneficial? And we don't have that research, but in general, when we're looking at gut health, that's the more stuff that we're looking towards. And if you're looking at probiotics, we've said this quite a few times, like probiotics are strain specific. So it's not just like you take a blanket probiotic and that is the answer for everything. And so there's even different probiotics for like IBS-C versus IBS-D, for example. So I would never just blanket recommend, okay, well, if there's dysbiosis, then that means that a probiotic is definitely going to help. Would I rule it out completely? No, but it's not like these supplements. I've not seen these menopause specific type of supplements. I don't know if you have, but they're not
Probably
something
the
that I'd recommend.
exact same with the menopause sticker put on it and charged twice as much.
Yeah, true. Oh, it's just shut down on me. Excuse me while I scroll back through. It takes a little bit of a time. I don't know why my app just closed. Okay.
It does take a lot of time. I was doing this today to try and like prep for the questions. I was like,
Wait a minute. Yeah,
wow,
maybe
years. Years.
time
Rolling.
for a new post. I do like it. Okay, Kelly's question. Hey ladies, what are your thoughts on this advert? It's meant to be about how IBS supposedly isn't caused by food, but instead a miscommunication between your brain and gut. And this advert says, fix the miscommunication between your gut and brain. Based on the latest IBS research, this thing can help you manage your IBS symptoms and feel better with a science-backed digital program. And basically what it is, I looked into it, I don't know if you did, was it's basically like therapy.
Oh yeah, no, this is a question that was up last week, right?
Yeah.
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 I did look at that. I was
What
like,
were
I mean, the only science-backed part of it that I kind of agreed with was like, well, yeah, if you reduce your stress, then you might see improvements in your IBS symptoms, yeah.
Yeah, and there is evidence around like CBT, mindfulness, which is often a larger part of DBT, smaller part of the larger DBT therapeutic approach. So yeah, there's a lot of evidence that says therapeutic approaches can support IBS, we know that IBS is linked to stress, like you said. So, but this is just branding of, this is just remarketing of something that we already know. I wouldn't spend up my money on what I assume that costs. But for people who with IBS, then maybe if it, and if there's a potential, if they're potentially, people who are high stress or have very busy lives or struggle to self-regulate and these types of things, then for sure that type of approach might be helpful. But I would probably go down more the self-refer through NHS for free if that's possible through, which I know it's not always possible. Okay, Annie's question. Happy Wednesday. Oh, she called us groovies. I like that.
What is what?
Groovies. Like groovy chicks. Remember groovy chick?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. First question. A client of mine includes chocolate regularly now. Oh, sorry. Let me start again. Client of mine includes chocolate regularly now without overeating, but is still aware she carries negative associations with it and thoughts of guilt come up occasionally. Just wondering how you'd help her break that down further from here. I probably wouldn't. I think you can kind of get to a point of like, you've clearly done amazing work together. She clearly is like, she's got pretty much food neutrality here. I would check in with like, do you still have conversations around this? Are there still influences in your life that can contribute to food guilt in this way? But honestly, if someone is, so Annie, you predominantly work with perimenopausal people. If someone is 50 years old and she spent 30 years feeling guilty about food and now about chocolate, and now she includes it. She notices that she feels guilty, but she has it anyway. And you've been working with her for a year. I think that's pretty spectacular. And I would just give it time. That would probably be my approach. I think like you could do some stuff around like thought work or like thought postponement where you just notice it and you and it's more like mindfulness of saying, oh, I recognize that I feel guilt, but I'm not going to get lost in it. And I'm just going to let that thought go and pass. And the more, and if that like if that intention is helpful or required, like over time she will need less and less intention of that, and that thought will just kind of maybe just pop in and go away again. And I think with food relationship stuff, sometimes that can be with people for a very long time, and sometimes it requires intention, and sometimes it's just an easier thing to let go of. But I wouldn't probably analyze it a lot more unless there was something obvious, just because it can become more conscious than is required.
Yeah, I also just don't think it's realistic a lot of the time to never ever have feelings of guilt around food. I do now and again. I'm like, I did eat too much there. Now, instead of what I might have previously done, it's just like beat myself up, write a really hard workout for the next day, go on a massive walk or something. I'm like, huh, I'm noticing that. And then I consciously know, it's not a valid thought. So I just kind of let it flow past. And it sounds like that's where this woman is. Like, and that to me, like, that's like a pretty good place to be. And like Amelia's saying, it probably happened less and less and less. But it will still, I think it will still pop up from time to time, especially when you've got other stuff going on, or you're hormonal, or you're having a bad day, or something. And you'll be like, oh, I feel a bit guilty about eating that. And then you're like, oh, no, wait, I don't need to. And instead of it staying with her for a full day and her feeling awful about it, it might stay with her for 5 minutes, then she moves on and forgets about it. I do think like I'm real advocate of the thought postponement, even if it's just see how you feel in an hour. Like, okay, cool, you're noticing that now, but that's because you feel a bit full. Now let's just see how you feel now. And normally people are like, oh, I don't really. Then when I try and think back of it in an hour, or I never even remember to think about it in the hour later, and I'm like, right, okay, fine, you're fine.
Also, there's a squeaky sound coming from my sofa, and I don't know if you can hear it, but it kind of sounds like a bit like a pump.
No.
Can you? Okay, good. Just in case you did, it's the sofa. Okay. Advice for exploring with a client who isn't sure whether the discomfort in their body is a case for work on body image or weight loss. They have hypertension and are conflicted if they need to lose to help with that, and that will help them feel more comfortable with their body.
They have hyper what?
They have hypertension and
All
they're
right.
conflicted in if they need to lose weight to help with that, and that they're then that will help them feel more comfortable with their body.
Are they overweight?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Possibly, I guess, but I shouldn't say.
I mean, they're almost two different things. Like, realistically, if you have hypertension because you're overweight, then you would want to lose weight to benefit your health. That might make you feel more comfortable in your body. It might not. But a lot of
Yeah.
that's psychological, right? Like, it's not necessarily the size at which you are, which will determine the comfort that you feel in your body. But it sometimes it does. And sometimes it's not because of the size that you are, but it's because you're taking action, you feel healthier, you can see the proof in that you've made these actions and you gave yourself a goal and you've achieved it and you feel more confident about yourself and you're exercising more and you've got more energy. Like, it's all the things that come around it. And hey, as a byproduct of all that stuff, you also lost a bit of weight and you're a bit smaller. But that's kind of the least important part.
Yeah, I think I think almost tackling it as like with the fat loss side of things, like we'll do okay, let's take body image stuff away from it. Like, do you want to lose fat? Like, is that important to you for your health or for anything else? Like, do you want to lose fat? And if it's like yes, okay, well, let's go on this fat loss journey whilst also doing the body image work, because it's likely that you're not going to reach this kind of point of body neutrality just by losing body fat. We know that that's probably not going to happen. However, you might see exactly what you said, like some benefits in terms of like feeling like you're supporting your health. But then on the flip side of that, you can get a lot of those feelings by focusing on your health and not losing fat, of like, okay, well, you might see a shift in, towards more body neutrality by taking all of these empowering actions to support your health, like, exercising more and reducing your saturated fat intake, etc., managing your stress, etc. And your body won't change, and we can still do body image work. I don't think, again, I think it's kind of like one of those situations where you don't necessarily have to know the specifics of the underlying things, and they might come up. It's more just like, okay, well, let's just be objective with this. Do you want to lose fat? No? Okay, fine, let's do some other things. And if it's, she'll probably say, yeah, but I don't know if it's because of my. Because I'm trying to improve my body image, or if it's because I'm trying to improve my health. It's like, okay, well, let's say your body image is going to change. Well, do you want to do it to support your health? Yes or no? And then that kind of tells you the answer. But on top of that, I also don't think it should be demonized to say, like, yes, we know that body image, right? Negative body image is associated with more frequent dieting, right? We know this, right? But that's not necessarily the case that you're not going to feel slightly more comfortable in your body by losing weight. And I think sometimes more the anti-diet community kind of conflate the two. And it's like, no, but everyone who diets more often is more likely to have a negative body image. It is true. But the same thing can be true of like you can also feel more comfortable in your body by losing weight. I think it's
But
naive
you
for
think
people to
the
do that.
causal element there is more about like your approach to it, right? Because if you're doing all those things, you're like, yeah, do you know what? I've started exercising more. I've started fueling my body better. I'm sleeping better. I'm doing these things to reduce my stress. Those are all like positive actions. But if you're framing them as positive actions, I highly doubt that if people were doing that and truly being able to frame them as positives, that would be associated with poorer body image.
Yeah, I think some of it's to do with like the constant body check-in and the constant like rating your success on your fat loss and all those things. But if you're,
And I agree with that, but that's to say that that is required to diet, which it's not, right?
yeah, but I think if it would be hard pushed to find someone who diets, and it's not impossible. Like, I'm sure you have clients, we have clients who do this too, but people who go on a fat loss journey who don't weigh themselves and don't look at their bodies regularly to check if they're losing fat. Like, I think that's quite hard to do, but not possible.
Yeah,
That's
no,
it.
I agree with that. Although I still think it like, and this is like not an argument that has like an out, like no one's right or wrong in this, but I still think it's more to do with how you're thinking about that. Well, I mean, it
Yeah.
definitely is. I think we can agree on that. Like, weight is just a number, right? So it's obviously how you're thinking about that and how you're gauging your progress. And if you're only using that as the only marker of progress, you're not looking at other outcomes and things. So I think you're taking a, as much as there's a correlation there, it's like, okay, well, what's like the causal part? It's the negative association with dieting that's causing the negative body image. I don't think it's inherently the fat loss itself.
Yeah. I guess it's probably a bit of both. What I do think is important is like this is an association of like more frequent diet and more body dissatisfaction, and it's like, yeah, but that's not to say that that comes as a result of more frequent diet, and it's that often people who have the lower body dissatisfaction diet more regularly because they're trying to improve their body image. So yeah, interesting. Okay, this is deep, I'm aware. But I'm wondering if you had any advice to support a client who struggles with compassion and shame after the physical and health effects of her past eating disorder are starting to surface now, later in life. She is in therapy too. What would I
It
do
is
next?
hard. And I know that, like, having worked with a lot of, I guess the link here to me that I've had the most experience with is people who are diagnosed with breast cancer. And then they're like, is that because I've been overweight? Is that, but, and you can't say there's no link there. Like, there is. There's a pretty strong link. And there's a lot of guilt that can be felt around that and shame. And there's no, I don't think there's an easy solution to that. I would definitely recommend therapy. Because, Brené Brown's taught us anything, like, it's really hard to change from that place. But equally, like, yeah, like, I can see why they feel that way. And I can't say that I wouldn't. Like, if I'd been smoking for 20 years and then got lung cancer, I'd be really pissed off at myself. Or even same, like, if I've not been wearing, I don't know, skin suntan lotion or something, and then I get skin cancer, it's almost like you're so pissed off at yourself. And that's not helpful. It doesn't help anyone, it makes you feel crap. But it also makes you less likely to engage in behaviors that are gonna, like, kind of think, right, well, where are you now? What can you do now? And it's really hard to get into that mindset, but that's where you need to get someone to a place of, like, right, well, that's done. Now you know what you know now. What can you do going forward?
Yeah, and it's that radical acceptance. Tara Brach's book, Radical Acceptance, might be quite a helpful read for these people, or for some of these people. It is just radical acceptance, and it's a book that, I read two-thirds of, and then I was like, okay, we get the point. But I think if you've not done radical acceptance practice before in any depth, then her work is really great for that. And it's just about acceptance of like, okay, well, what can we change? What can't we change? And letting that go. And maybe a little bit of like that younger self-compassion could be quite helpful here. Of a lot of people that I work with do really like to have like the screensaver of themselves as a kid on their phone. And I actually have mine on my phone, but it's rare that I have to look at it and be like, well, what does she need right now? But I do think that that type of thing can be really helpful of like, okay, well, I wonder if they can. Because eating disorders served a purpose, right? Let's take a made-up mythical example of someone who developed an eating disorder, binge eating disorder, to manage their emotions when they had a grief when they were young, right? And rather than, because what's happening right now is they're really angry and feel shameful about themselves as adults for the behaviors that they had maybe as an adult, but and eating disorders, of course, can develop then. But at that point of onset of eating disorder or disordered eating, that was serving a purpose for them, right? And that was their eating disorder was trying to protect them in some way from something. And I wonder if they can look at the person who was before the eating disorder, whatever age that is, it might be 12, it might be 25, and say, like, and nurture them and be like, I'm sorry that like you went through this. I'm sorry that that experience happened to you, and offer compassion in that sense, and also be thankful in a way of like, I appreciate that you did the best that like that was the best thing that you could do. And from a personal experience of like my binge eating malarkey for so long, it's like I something it's not easy, but I still say to myself like that binge eating for me allowed me to show up in my family in the way that I felt like that was the right thing for me to do for my family. And I don't, I'm not glad that I had it and struggled with it for so long, but that was my coping mechanism that allowed me to support whatever, right? And that 16-year-old me, a lot of the work that I did as I got older was about offering compassion to that version, that 16-year-old me or that 15-year-old me. And I wonder if there's an element of that. And again, like she'll probably, they'll probably be doing some of that in therapy, but And it's not for you to go way when outside of your scope of practice in this, but asking a question of like, I wonder if you could nurture that person before in some way. I think that's within your scope of practice, just not having obviously the depth of conversations that they'd have in therapy. Okay, Amanda's question. Hi, ladies. A client of mine is going through menopause and was told by her GP to go on a gluten-free diet to improve her migraines. Is there, I feel like this question is made for you. Is there a correlation between perimenopause and developing some sort of gluten intolerance? Would women going through it benefit from reducing the amounts of or going gluten-free, or would there be any other changes that could potentially be? Thanks a
You
million.
definitely don't need to go gluten free if you're going through perimenopause. I've not seen much that relates gluten to migraines, but that's not like migraines can be triggered by, like, I mean, I've seen so many different triggers to migraines. And I don't think, honestly, I say I don't think I know enough. I don't think anybody knows enough to know that you could be like, that's definitely not, or that definitely can't, or something. So if she cuts it out and she doesn't get migraines anymore, fine. I would imagine the reason she's getting more migraines going through menopause is because of the hormonal fluctuations. Like, hormonal fluctuations are one of the biggest triggers for migraines. That's definitely a trigger for me. That to me would seem like a much more likely thing to be causing it, rather than like suddenly at, I don't know, I'm imagining about 50 years old developing an intolerance to gluten that's causing migraines.
I agree. I have nothing to add. It is annoying when, like, doctors are fantastic, of course, at what they do, but it is annoying when they give out nutrition advice that is just plucked from thin air.
Yeah.
Like, I think this is what we should do. Like, okay. When, especially when something like hormonal fluctuations are staring you right in the face.
Yeah, I know, it's like the almost like the most common cause, I would suggest. I can't think of anything else that's probably more common. Caffeine, maybe chocolate for some people. But yeah, interesting.
Okay, Monta's question. I had a question on the back end of body weight and health lecture. You covered liposuction, but what about lemon bottle? Had you heard of lemon bottle? I had to Google it.
I googled it last time, yeah.
Okay. This was only 6 days ago, babe. How did you do
Did I
that?
not get the same question last time then? Or maybe I got another one about it's like fat dissolving lemon juice or
Maybe
something.
we did. It's not lemon juice, but it's like fat dissolve. It's just a fat dissolving injection of things.
Did we
It's
get
becoming
fat freezing last time?
possibly. It's becoming increasingly popular, and I've had some clients ask about it, which I've steered them away from, as I don't believe it's necessary when they are already putting the work in to improve their lifestyle and habits and losing fat sustainably and naturally. I've tried to find some research, but really struggling with this to back up what I advise. So I looked at the actual constituents of it. Do you want to know what's in it? Can't find it. It's like vitamin. It's like a vitamin mix, and then bromelain, which I don't even know. But I was looking up all the evidence for like the specific constituents of it. But that specific ingredient. There's some evidence in mice. And then that's it. Like this specific constitution of injectable, there's zero evidence for whatsoever. There is some evidence for other potential, what's the word I'm looking for, constituents, but in this, like, zero evidence. Like, it's
What, so
what I got.
was it trying to dissolve the fat cell?
Yeah, it's still trying to dissolve the fat cells, and it's all the evidence anecdotal or some in mice. But what I thought was interesting when I was reading about it is that the way that they're selling this lemon bottle is as cosmetic treatment, not obesity. So they don't need any medical trials, clinical trials. They don't need any of that because they're selling it as cosmetic. So they can just be like, oh yeah, there's evidence in mice or whatever, and then that's what they're selling.
Quite
Wild,
scary.
isn't it a wild distinction? And I just think, I wonder how many other like kind of cosmetic treatments that seem kind of medical grade are on that similar sort of wavelength.
Know what you should send to her is, and now I can't remember the woman's name, but there was a woman who got fat dissolving injections. It was more the fat freezing thing. And this is like quite a rare side effect, right? But it almost like the opposite happened. And this does happen. So I had a client who the same happened. She got them around her stomach and they started to just like it formed like this big tumor. She had to get an operation to get it out. She lives in America. It cost thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds. And this was like big. I did a podcast on it actually. If you want to go and listen, let me know and I will send you the link. But it really puts people off. And the reason I wanted to get her on is just to be like, talk to her about like, okay, well, why did you do it? What would you suggest to someone that feels like this? What happened to you? What was your experience? Now, it's normally enough to people off, especially if you found the picture of this woman.
No, I was Googling Linda Evangelista because she had a really bad fat freezing experience too, and her face like,
That's who I'm talking about. Yeah.
oh,
Even
okay.
if you show someone that it's normally like enough to be like, I wouldn't even consider risking that happening. And things like that can go wrong, especially when, like it's not been tested. It's probably some woman down at the beauty salon that's doing it, not like a trained professional. You don't really know what's in it, and it's just not worth it. Like the other thing is the benefit of something like that, and this is why it has different dangers to liposuction, because at least with liposuction, it's medical professionals, right? But then you are taking out such a significant amount of fat cells that you are kind of impacting your ability to safely store body fat, which if you're not changing your behaviors, you'll be putting back on. But now it's going to be put back on more viscerally in more dangerous places because you've got less subcutaneous fat. But with these like fat dissolving injections, like they're not that effective. So it's probably that isn't the issue anymore. Like, you're going to kill some fat cells, but it's not going to have a huge issue, like a huge impact there. But it's more, like the negative side effects when it's not really been tested. It, at best, it's probably a waste of money, but at worst, something potentially bad could happen.
And also, like Linda Evangelista is a multimillionaire. Like, so it's not like she's just gone down to the local beauticians and paid, 40 quid for some fat freezing injection. She's probably gone to someone who charges a lot of money, and who knows, they may well be a medical professional at this but that pay grade. I don't know, but she's a celebrity. Like, she's gone an A-list celebrity. She's got the right stuff. So,
What's her name? Lisa.
Linda Evangelista.
Linda.
Also, this is sort of on this topic, right? But I was listening to, for some reason, I think it must be something to do with parenting advice on my TikTok. Holly Hagen came up from Geordie Shore, and she got a BBL. And so the way that they do it with BBL is they remove fat cells from like your midsection, and then they put them on your arse. And she was saying that, yeah, when I gain weight, my arse just gets absolutely massive because obviously that's where my fat cells are. We shouldn't say that, but like obviously that's what that is. So I thought, I was like, that interesting. So if you get a BBL and you gain weight, you get a BBBL.
I didn't know
I know.
that.
I know
Okay, this
it's
isn't the person I
quite
was thinking of, but another example. Is that what happened? Oh yeah, CoolScope sculpting. Oh yeah. She looks very different,
so
doesn't she?
yeah, but I like that she came out as a celebrity and was like, this is what I did and this is what happened.
Yeah.
But it doesn't stop people. It never stopped 10 people getting their lips done after that. Leslie, someone got her lips done and they went really big back in the day.
Oh, Leslie. Hi.
Big Leslie.
Hi, Leslie with the big lips. No, I don't know who you're talking about.
She was from a really famous BBC program that I don't know the name of. Okay, next question. Julie's question. I think, oh, so Julie asked the question about alcohol last time. I think my question is specifically around it, alcohol being termed as the fourth macronutrient because it has calories, but where does it fit in that sense as a macronutrient? Our bodies prefer carbs as an energy source, but where does alcohol, I'm not sure what that means, but enter source compared to fats and proteins. I understand that alcohol doesn't have any other nutritional benefit and the negative behavioral impact, but interested in the metabolic aspect. Holy moly, what's happening to my words? So alcohol will be oxidized preferentially to other macronutrients. because your body's trying to metabolize it first. So it halts things like lipolysis, like breakdown of fat, for example, to try and oxidize the alcohol, metabolize ethanol, etc., from there. So in the metabolic sense, that's what happens. If you drink alcohol, that will be metabolized first at the expense of other things. I hate the narrative that's the fourth macronutrient. I think that's
Yeah,
like,
of
I'm
course,
not
but
in
and
my
then it's
lifetime.
like, because people will be like, oh, it blunts fat burning, but it's like, yeah, but so does like, eating carbs as well, but it's not necessarily like the end of the world. I wonder what happens as you were talking there. I was like, oh, what about people who really just don't metabolize alcohol well? They lack the enzyme to break it down in the same way that other people
Yeah,
do.
I don't know. I don't know.
And it's so dangerous because it stays at like toxic levels for so much longer.
Is and I don't know the specifics of this, but I feel like this is what the link is between fatty liver for people with who are people with alcoholism may well be related to the fatty liver, the fact that you're constantly metabolizing that potentially, but I might be off mark on that.
Yeah,
That's
because it's
nothing to do.
mostly. I think it's South Asians, or maybe there's a certain gene that most Asians have or lack that metabolizes alcohol, which is why they'll get drunk much quicker because we break it down. Like the half-life of alcohol for Caucasians is much lower than Asians.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, because my flatmate at uni obviously didn't metabolize alcohol very much, got drunk really quickly, but also you just see it in her face. It was like go completely red straight away.
Oh, I had a friend like that too, from the neck up.
Yeah.
Kind of, why is my face like that right now?
I don't know, I was just thinking you were looking rosy.
I am rosy, but I'm not sure why. I don't think it's rosy. I think it's red. But thanks. Okay, Tara's question. I am watching lecture three on body weight and health, which has been really interesting. On the slide where it says being fit and obese is more protective against cardiovascular disease than being a normal weight. We're going to go with a healthy weight, but not fit. I'm just curious as to what defines being fit. Is it just based on testing your VO2 max? Thanks in advance.
Yeah, so if I remember correctly, they categorized these people into like percentiles of weight and fitness. So it was based on VO2 max. It wasn't like there was a specific cutoff. It was like those in the top percentile of VO2 max versus the middle versus the bottom. But that's how they measured it would be VO2 max, yeah.
Okay. Most research, if they're looking at like fitness, they'll usually explain in like their abstract, if you're looking at research, like what they're def like how they're measuring fitness, physical fitness, and a large majority of the time it's VO2 max.
Yeah, with this, I'm pretty sure it was, well, it was VO2 max, but yeah, I'm pretty sure it was like quite a big observational study. And they were more just splitting people into kind of like groups of like the most fit group versus the least fit group in comparison to their weight as well, and what was more indicative of health outcomes.
Remember the graph. Okay, Laura's question. I was wondering if anyone has any experience, their own or with their clients, with nutrition and exercise during Ramadan. I have a client doing Ramadan in March, and I want to make sure she has a plan in place. She is an in-person client doing two sessions per week with me in the gym. She's thinking she'll be okay for her sessions if they're fairly early in day during Ramadan, but also want to advise her on how best to fuel herself when only eating late in the evening and super early in the morning. Can I say that two people that put out really good content around this are Maya, mentored by Maya, who's a EIQ grad, and Mobina. I feel like her Instagram handle is mentored by Mobina, but I'm not 100% sure, but they do share posts. They do some really great stuff around Ramadan. So just I would if you want like lots of stuff on that, I would look at their stuff, or at least they did last year, so I assume they will again this year.
I mean, the slight benefit is that it starts what, like mid-March, right? So you still have, like, when Ramadan is in the summer, I just think it's really hard because the sun, especially in Scotland, like the sun doesn't go down until like 9 p.m. and then it comes up at like, 4 in the morning or something, and it's like really, really tough to do. And I'm not saying it's not tough out with those times, but it's significantly easier when the sun goes down at a normal time or like an earlier time and rises at a later time as well. I've had quite a few clients doing Ramadan, and they've actually continued to exercise. Now, one thing that I didn't encourage, but a lot of people wanted to do, is that they would exercise before they break their fast. The reason I didn't really like that is not so much because they've not eaten all day. I think most people are actually fine with that, especially if you're used to fasting. It was more that they've not had anything to drink all day. That's what worried me. These people were in Scotland. Again, it's not like they probably would have sweated much during the day. It's like cold all the time. But if you haven't had anything to drink all day. Now, this also depends on how strict you are, because a lot of my clients did still continue to drink water or drank some water while they were exercising. Now, I think there's like different rules depending on, like, yeah, I guess how seriously you want to stick to them. But also sometimes people, you know, some of my clients were like, oh no, you're allowed to drink during exercise. I don't know, right? Like, I don't know the ins and outs, and I think that does depend a little bit. But yeah, that my main concern would be dehydration as opposed to like the lack of food. I do think it makes sense if she was going to exercise in the morning, because then she can eat beforehand and drink beforehand. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I've always been led by my clients on this one, 100%. And we've always had, like, what's quite nice about Ramadan often is that it presents a really lovely time to focus on, like, being mindful and being around the experience of food and celebrating food for in the context, in a wider context, away from food is fuel or food is calories or, you know, whatever. With the type of people that I work with, people, the type of situations that I work with, I've always encouraged people to really lean into that, and it's a nice experience for them in that way. And then with the actual practicalities of that, I just say, when would feel better for you? What's worked for you in the past? There's no pressure. Usually I'll reduce their training volume. And just because they, like, if especially it depends what they're doing. Like, if they're training 3 times a week or something, then it's fine. But if they're on the higher end of the things, then often I'll reduce that a little bit. And if they're people who tend to overeat, now again, it depends on their family and what they're doing. But if they're people who struggle with binge eating or overeating, then I'll really focus on that first period of breaking the fast. Of I won't ask them to change what they're doing, but I will say, okay, well, is there a way somehow that you can, like, you know, have a really, like, have a protein source first, or can you sit down and have, like, a really mindful moment first, or do something? Because ultimately you're still breaking a fast, and the potential for that, if somebody overeats or binge eats, the potential for mindless eating at that point is higher. So I'm usually mindful of that, but again, the practicalities of it around training and stuff is like, what feels best for you? Let's do that.
And definitely get them to rehydrate, because I mean, the standard, oh, you might be eating more because you're actually thirsty, but even more true if you've not been drinking all day. The other thing that I've noticed is that at the start, normally people cope quite well, and then you probably will have to reduce their training volume or even cut it out completely as the month goes on. But then another thing that I think is quite cool from a psychological perspective, even if you don't do Ramadan, right? But if you're someone who's like, oh God, I just, you know, like, how do I stop myself just overeating in the middle of the day or something? Or like, if I'm hungry, like, why can't, you know, I just end up eating, and it almost like you're a victim to it and there's nothing you can do about it. And then when you realize what you're capable of, when you have like, I guess, a why, like a very good why, right? Same kind of principle as when, I don't know, I've had a client for years who's always struggled with drinking socially. Has been like, you know, she'd do periods of time where she wouldn't drink as much, but she's always like found it's been a bit of a crux. Then about 6 months ago, she got pregnant. She's obviously not had any alcohol and has been fine with it. Why? Because she had like a reason not to have it. I think before she was like, I noticed that this isn't great for me and that I feel pretty crap the next day, but I still do it. Now, obviously, there was a reason that she was doing it, and like she obviously enjoyed it to an extent, at least at the time, right? But now it's like, well, you kind of can't do it. And it kind of makes you realize what you are capable of. Like, this is why I always use it, like, as an example with clients, like, if I had a gun to your dog's head, like, would you get your steps in? And they're like, what the hell's wrong with you? But yes, of course I would. Like, you are capable. But once you accept to, like, you know, once you tell yourself, like, I am capable of doing this, then you're kind of like, well, I'm choosing not to. Okay, well, why are you choosing not to? And that's not to say it then becomes easy just because you can. But it kind of, like, you know, you stop telling yourself, I can't do it. You're saying now, like, I'm choosing not to do it because I'd rather do this. Okay, fine. Now you're actually being real with yourself. It's not that you can't, it's that you don't want to, or you don't want to enough. And I think sometimes, you know, like, I don't even think you need to do ramp down to realize that. Like, I often think that I'm like, oh God, I'm really hungry. And then, like, oh, but my mate's fasting all day. Like, I'm pretty sure I can push my dinner back an hour because I'm busy doing something else, or, like, I don't know, whatever it might be. Just makes you realize what you're capable of, I think.
Okay. Great questions. Keep coming in, everyone.
Okay, bye.
Bye.